what's happening down on Main. Except a little rain.
Hello and welcome once again to the St. Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St. Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding areas. This is the primary edition for the 7 days beginning Saturday the 8th of February 2025. My name is Ian, I edit and produce this programme. This edition of Primary will once again be distributed on USB sticks. Please remember to return them in the wallet provided when you have finished listening. Additionally, the programme is available on our website, sadtn.org.uk, under Listen Online. If you are using a mobile device, then it's available via the British Wireless for the Blind Fund app. This can be downloaded free via iTunes or Google Play. Search for Talking Newspaper. Amongst other items, this edition has, as usual on the USB stick distribution only, the BBC In Touch podcast. We'll also have the usual news roundup and the national radio listings. Once again, we'll be delving into the London Beyond Sight archives. This time a description of the Buxton Memorial Fountain by David Harewood. There will also be the list of audio-described programmes on television, courtesy of the Wharfdale Talking Newspaper, and Peter Burley will be presenting his look at events and entertainment in the area. To finish, I'll be looking at past events and birthdates in the upcoming week. This week's music is Watertown, sung by Frank Sinatra. Sinatra, of course, doesn't need any introduction, but the story behind this song is, I hope, interesting. More later. Let's move on to the news read by Deborah, Andy, Jane, Christine, and Keith.
This is Keith McDougall. One-way layout to remain in George Street. Traffic restrictions in a St. Albans city centre road are set to stay after a public consultation. After receiving more than 800 responses, Hertfordshire County Council has decided the current traffic restrictions in George Street will remain in place. This follows three quarters of respondents expressing their support for keeping the revised layout. The current system, in place since November 2023, allows traffic on George Street from Monday to Saturday morning with a one-way layout. However, the street is accessible to pedestrians and cyclists only from 11 a.m. on Saturday until 7 a.m. on Monday. After the public consultation, a project board consisting of councillors and officers from Hertfordshire County Council, St Albans City and District Council and the St Albans BID has confirmed that the present traffic management and road layout will be retained. They will also explore making some minor changes, such as replacing temporary plastic bollards and planters with more permanent fixtures. Out of the 804 responses to the survey, 72% supported keeping the one-way system with weekend traffic restrictions to create a more people-friendly space. Meanwhile, 15% backed the current system but suggested minor changes. Only 12% wished for the road to revert to a two-way system 7 days a week. The initial closure of George Street, High Street and Marketplace was introduced in the summer of 2020 to allow more space for social distancing during COVID-19 and to encourage people to return to the city centre post-pandemic. Following similar feedback, Marketplace has been permanently closed to traffic except for deliveries between 7 a.m. and 11 a.m, while the High Street has been reopened. Councillor Phil Bibby, Executive Member for Highways and Transport at Hertfordshire County Council, said, "George Street is a wonderful historic street that is not well suited to two-way traffic. This new layout on George Street supports our vision of creating a cleaner, greener, healthier Hertfordshire, while also helping local businesses to thrive."
Hello, my name's Deborah, and my first piece is headed New Charges Set to Affect On-Street Parking Bays. New parking charges are set to affect more than 300 bays across St Albans and Harpenden later this month. Fees are to be introduced at some limited waiting on-street parking bays in the district following an extensive public consultation. St Albans City and District Council's, SADC's, original proposals have been modified due to feedback from residents, councillors, businesses and community groups. The charges will impact an additional 243 bays in Harpenden and an additional 70 in St Albans, and are due to come into effect on Monday, February the 17th. Four new disabled bays are also being created to provide improved parking facilities for motorists with blue badges in Harpenden's town centre. Councillor Helen Campbell, lead for parking, said, "I fully understand that some people will be disappointed at being charged for a service that they have been getting for free. In making the decision, we analysed the responses to the consultations and engaged with stakeholders such as ward councillors and Harpenden Town Council. We listened to the feedback and we made some significant changes as a result, such as changing the start of the controlled hours to 9 a.m. in Harpenden to help parents dropping off for school, and meeting requests for a longer free period of 30 minutes. In addition, we will also be improving access to Harpenden Town Centre for blue badge holders. Motorists will have several payment options, including contactless via pay and display machines, with new equipment to be installed at key locations, the mobile phone app, Pay by Phone, and soon after implementation, by cash or chip and pin at Paypoint outlets." Councillor Campbell added, "The charges are benchmarked against many other local authorities, with many towns of a similar size to Harpenden having long had charges for on-street bays. As with other parking charges, we will monitor the impact of the changes and review if necessary. One aim of the proposals is to encourage active travel, such as cycling and walking where possible, rather than car use, to improve the local environment. Another aim is to ensure a greater turnover of premium parking places and improve enforcement by enabling new methods such as automatic number plate recognition. The charges will apply from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. in Harpenden and, reflecting local conditions, 8:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. in St Albans, both Monday to Saturday, with no charge outside these hours. Allow for a 30 minutes free period once a day. Be £1.25 for 30 minutes, so the charge for a 1 hour stay will be £1.25, while the 2 hour cost will be £3.75, both including the free period. Cover a maximum stay of 2 hours with no return for 2 hours. Fees will not be considered at the bays in York Road, St Albans, as originally proposed, until a wider review of parking in the area takes place. Five limited waiting bays in Leighton Green, Harpenden, will be converted into resident parking bays for the benefit of local households. Revenue from charges will go towards the council's on-street services budget, which is currently running at a deficit, and towards greater levels of parking enforcement. Alongside these changes to the way on-street parking operates, the council has also approved a new access pass to help older people who may have difficulties with digital applications. This pass will be made available for purchase from Thursday, February the 13th, and will cover all the district council car parks. The pass will cost £190 for a year and be valid for one visit a day for up to 3 hours. To be eligible for the pass, a person would need to be a resident of the district and age 70 or over.
Hello, I'm Andy. Major scheme to transform park. The subheading, Lakes Improvements Approved by Council. A scheme to improve Verulamium Park's artificial lakes and an adjoining meadow has been approved. The project will create new wetlands, nature walks and plant beds to enhance biodiversity and water quality. A key feature will be the dredging of the heavily silted lakes, with the silt recycled to form fertile planting areas around the edges. Councillors on the Public Realm Committee of St Albans City and District Council, which owns the park, approved the scheme at its meeting on Tuesday, January 28th. The project is expected to cost a seven-figure sum, with the council previously setting aside a £2.2 million budget for the work. Councillor Helen Campbell, the committee's chair, said, "This is a landmark moment for the council and everyone who loves our flagship Verulamium Park. I'm thrilled that we have at last agreed a sound and exciting plan for an area of the park that is in need of improvement." The council had been exploring various options for improving the area around the lakes and Bell Meadow, which is currently closed for safety reasons due to persistent flooding. The lakes were built more than 80 years ago to a design that would not be allowed today. The working group set up to look at options has ruled out returning the Ver to its natural path, as it would cost between £4 and £6 million, well beyond the available budget. The group's preferred option, accepted by the committee at its meeting, is to retain the river in its current channel, but create a wetland in the meadow along with a permanent raised footpath. Councillor Campbell added, "I know our residents are keen to see this area of the park improved, but I would warn this is a long-term project and it will be a few years before it's completed. The goal is to transform this area of much-loved Verulamium Park and create new wetlands, footpaths, wildlife habitats and nature walks. The council has been working with partner organisations, including the Environment Agency, on a project to revitalise the River Ver as it flows through central St Albans."
Hello, I'm Jane Wilson, and my first article today is Oaklands College to delay parking charge changes. Oaklands College has decided to delay the rollout of parking charges across its St Albans campus, previously announced in December. The college has pushed back the changes as it finds a solution that aligns with both community needs and its operational requirements. Parking controls were initially introduced over 18 years ago, and they were set for a return to fund security and safety, improve parking management, and address infrastructure needs. The alterations have faced backlash, with one frequent car park user, who wished to remain anonymous, calling them a fiasco. They commented, "The changes have not been communicated at all to the many parents who drop off children for sporting activities, for whom this would be an enormous extra cost. Each week, one training and one match that take over 2 hours, but under 3 hours, would be an extra £6, more than most pay to take part in the sport itself." However, a spokesperson for the college has now said that the reintroduction of parking controls through an automatic number plate recognition system will be delayed. The college wants to ensure that anything implemented meets the needs of all users, supports the sustainability of its facilities, and is introduced in a way that is both fair and well understood. Taking this pause allows us to carefully review and refine our approach and minimise any unintended consequences, the spokesperson said. It will also give us the opportunity to implement a solution that aligns with both community needs and the college's operational requirements, and ensure that this is fully communicated to all external users and stakeholders, including the many sports clubs that use our facilities. Parking charges will still be introduced at the Welling Garden City campus, and for the first time ever, the staff car park at the rear of the WGC campus will be open on weekends, giving visitors a wider choice of parking locations. The spokesperson added, "We've worked with the car park operator to keep charges as low as possible, with 1 hour costing £1 and 1 to 2 hours costing £2. 2 to 4 hours, £2.50, and 24 hours costs £5. By opening the Welling campus car park, we're providing cost-effective parking within a 5-minute walk of all the shops and attractions. It is not yet confirmed when the parking charges will be introduced in St Albans."
Hello, my name's Christine Stanley, and I have an item which is a tribute paid to a legend named Jean. A charity fundraising champion dies aged 82. Tributes have been paid to a legendary community champion who helped raise thousands of pounds for charities in and around St Albans. Jean Eaton died at the age of 82 on December 29th last year, with her funeral being held on January 29th. Known for her volunteering and fundraising work in Redbourne and St Albans, she gave up her time for a number of causes, with Soroptimists International paying tribute to Jean. Jean's fundraising skills were legendary, along with networking and having fun, the tribute read. She worked closely with many charities, and particularly with Grove House in St Albans and the St Albans and Hartsmere Women's Refuge, raising thousands of pounds for them. Jean always said fundraising wasn't just about the money, it was also about having fun, developing relationships, and raising the profile of the charity or cause. This is why Jean became friends with so many people. Some of her volunteering was done through her membership of the local women's group Soroptimists International St Albans and District, which she was president of twice. As a chartered accountant, she was a brilliant treasurer for much of her time since joining in 2000. Jean always had great ideas and supported events with her signature smile, energy and enthusiasm, like organising 100 laps of the lake in Verulamium Park to celebrate Soroptimists International's 100th anniversary, and running the Magistrates Court Tea Bar to raise money for Grove House. Jean was also a great traveller and had friends all over the world. Since Jean died, tributes have been pouring in from far and wide. Jean was active in many organisations, including the WI, U3A, Abbey Theatre and RADA. Many donations will be split between Cancer Research and Soroptimists International St Albans and District. And there's a photograph of Jean standing modelling some clothing with a group of women sitting around on chairs around her. And there's another photograph in a field with a gazebo and some bunting and a group of women, all women and one man and one dog, and two women in the front row, one of whom is Jean, have a coffee table and they're attempting to cut what looks like a celebratory cake.
Lord Lieutenant hosts Holocaust event at Cathedral. Several hundred pupils from six different local services gathered in the nave of St Albans Cathedral to hear from survivors of the European Holocaust. The event took place on January the 30th and 31st, commemorating 80 years since the end of the Second World War and 3 days after a ceremony to mark the liberation of Auschwitz, the most notorious Nazi concentration camp where more than 1 million Jews were murdered. This is the second year that this programme, initiated by the Lord Lieutenant of Hertfordshire, Robert Voss, has been held in the Cathedral. It's organised by the Cathedral's education team and supported by the Holocaust Education Trust, the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust and the Viner Library. Pupils from years 6 to 11 each attended two different workshops hosted by the three organisations to give them an insight into life for Jews throughout Europe before the Second World War and how the Holocaust came about. Some of the figures provided about the Jewish communities in both East and West Europe certainly surprised many students. All the students then gathered in the nave of the cathedral to hear testimonies from survivors of the Holocaust in Europe, as well as the more recent genocide in Cambodia. The Lord Lieutenant also told the story of his own family and his grandparents who were murdered in the gas chambers. A Q&A session followed with a large number of interesting and meaningful questions for each of the speakers. After a period of reflection, the students departed in what can only be described as stunned silence. The Lord Lieutenant said afterwards that he was extremely grateful to the cathedral staff as well as the three Holocaust organisations for once again supporting the event, which is hoped will go ahead again next year. He said, "Obviously I have a direct connection to the subject as my own parents went through this terrible time, escaping Germany and arriving in Britain as refugees, and I will ever be grateful for this country for accepting them and allowing them to build their lives in the country they loved as home. It was also in memory of more than 60 members of my family who were murdered simply because of their religion. I feel it is so important for young people to learn about the Holocaust and the context in which it came about, in the hope that humanity will never again allow such a terrible and tragic time as happened in our recent history."
talented teen to fence for Team GB. A talented student from St Albans School has become the youngest fencer on the Team GB squad at just 17 years old. Ava Davis, who is a Year 12 student, competed with the senior GB fencing squad at an international senior Grand Prix fencing tournament in Tunisia. She is currently the youngest member of the British fencing squad and has been selected to represent Britain, competing alongside 250 elite fencers from across the globe. During the tournament, Ava stayed with her team and the other competing athletes at a hotel close to the tournament in Tunis. It was really cool coming face to face with the people I usually watch on TV and in YouTube videos, she said. Sitting with these talented athletes on the bus, as well as training with them and fencing with them, was such an incredible experience. Fencing was practiced at St Albans School over a century ago and has recently been reintroduced as a co-curricular activity. Martin Langston, Director of Sport at St Albans School, commented, "Fencing is a great way for young people to start building confidence and essential life skills that extend way beyond the confines of the sport itself. The sport teaches perseverance, resilience, and the ability to handle pressure in a safe and structured way, as well as being mentally stimulating and physically driven. We are really proud of Ava's incredible success in the sport. It is such an honour and an achievement to be representing Team GB at her young age. And we wish her every success in her upcoming competitions." Having also achieved a bronze medal at the Commonwealth Fencing Championships in New Zealand during the summer of 2024, and more recently gaining a silver medal at the EFC-FFE Circuit Udine in Italy, Ava is keen to pursue her ambitions of one day competing at the Olympics. "It's the dream," Ava added, "although I know it will take a lot of dedication, perseverance and training to get there." Since the Commonwealth Championships, the teenager has been selected to represent Team GB under-23 and under-20 competitions in Belgium, Bulgaria, Tunisia, Germany and Hungary, and is currently qualifying to become a fencing coach.
This article is headlined, "Landlords Bid Farewell. Beloved bosses leave pub after 11 years at the helm." Two beloved landlords are set to leave their Sandridge pub with a heavy heart after more than a decade in charge. The Queen's Head will bid farewell to its long-term stewards on Saturday, February the 8th, ahead of a management changeover. In 11 years, owners Sharon and Ross have seen it all. One flood, two fires and a pandemic have all passed, and they are proud to have fought through it all. "We've been through a lot of adversity, but we wouldn't give in," Ross said. "We're proud to get to the end of our second term and not quit." The pair have built a strong following at the pub, with some people reportedly moving closer to enjoy its offerings. Ross believes they were best known for a brilliant Sunday roast where they could turn over up to 150 covers. "One of the best things, our flagship, is our fabulous Sunday roast offering. We're full every Sunday." Another flagship was the Queen's Stock Festival, hosted annually, which reflected their ambition to transform the pub into a summer venue. News of the landlord's departure broke via the pub's Facebook page last week. The duo extended their gratitude to all their staff, but would not have to miss the regulars. "We live close enough. We won't miss the locals," Ross said jovially. "Don't worry, we won't be leaving the country. We'll miss our wonderful staff, though. We've all become friends." When asked why they were not renewing their lease with Stonegate, Ross highlighted rising costs as a key factor, suggesting they do not make enough to pay the bills, despite support from regulars. "It's come to that time," he added. "No matter how hard we work, I don't think it's going to happen for the next 5 years." My heart still loves it and wants it, but my head says no. Sharon and Ross previously ran the Gibraltar Castle in Harpenden and currently own the Green Dragon in London Colney. Currently, Stonegate are searching for new tenants to take over the Queen's Head, and the couple wished all the best to their successors. Ross said, "We've been told there are three potential people talking to Stonegate, and we will leave the pub in pristine condition when we hand the keys over." And there's a very nice photo of the smiling Sharon and Ross together, and it tells us underneath that they have owned multiple pubs across Hertfordshire.
Motorist banned for driving while on drugs. A motorist has been banned after admitting to driving while under the influence of ketamine and cocaine. Benjamin Grant of Little Oxy Lane, Watford, has been banned from driving for 29 months after pleading guilty to the offence at St Albans Magistrates Court last month. On Thursday, January 23rd, the sentence was handed down at the same court, which also includes 6 months of non-residential rehabilitation and a requirement to complete 150 hours of unpaid work over the next year. Court documents state that in St Albans on July 4th, 2024, the 22-year-old drove a BMW with large amounts of ketamine and benzoylecanine, a primary substance in cocaine, in his system. Grant has also been ordered to pay costs of £199, consisting of a £114 surcharge and an £85 payment to the Crown Prosecution Service. This sum must be paid within 28 days of the order being made. According to documents, his guilty plea was taken into account when handing down sentencing.
Vehicles are stopped from entering the district to deter and detect crime. More than 40 vehicles have been prevented from entering the St Albans district amid a police crackdown. The stops were conducted during night patrols by Intervention Team A to deter and detect felons potentially committing crime. Three drivers were also found without insurance and had their vehicles seized, and a further 8 individuals were stopped, searched, and dealt with for relevant offences. A Facebook page, a post by St Albans Police, read, "Intervention Team A were working the night shift for the last couple of days, and what better way to spend it by proactively patrolling our hotspot areas where criminals were using the night time to commit crime. Here is what we got up to over the last couple of days. Three drivers were found driving without insurance, and those vehicles were seized. 8 individuals were stopped and searched and dealt with for relevant offences. Over 40 vehicles stopped entering the St Albans district to detect and deter criminals entering our CSP to commit crime," the post added. One pedal cycle recovered after two males were stopped on Harpenden Road by Rhodes policing colleagues, where one of them ran off. The pedal cycle was then revealed to be stolen and is waiting to be picked up by the rightful owner.
St Albans councillor joins fight for county seat in Harpenden. The former St Albans mayor and current Verulam Ward district councillor Edgar Hill has been named as the Liberal Democrats candidate for Harpenden South West in May's county council elections. He explained why he stepped forward. "I have enjoyed an association with Harpenden for many years. I have many friends I play golf with at the Harpenden Common Golf Club, routinely indulge in the excellent hospitality Harpenden has to offer, and I was also privileged to open the Eric Morecambe Centre and Sports Pavilion in Harpenden when I was mayor." He said the recent St Albans District Council decision to charge for on-street parking in the town was not relevant to the role. He said, "Parking charges do not fall within the remit of the County Council. Whoever is elected as the County Councillor for Harpenden South West will not have a mandate or indeed have any influence on that issue." He added, "A Liberal Democrat administration in County Hall will offer a credible alternative to current Conservative failings. My focus will be on special educational needs and disabilities provision, where the Conservative-controlled council has failed time and again to secure the necessary funding. Also, adult social care is so important to families when the need strikes, and the Liberal Democrats are leading on how we must address the crisis there. And, of course, I hear repeatedly about the terrible state of the roads and pavements in this division. In the coming months leading up to the elections on May the 1st, I will be taking advantage of the cycle highway and the short bike ride between where I live and Harpenden to continue to meet residents on the doorstep. Given the opportunity, I can do something about the potholes, blocked drains, flooding and speeding vehicles, all of which are concerns being raised to me. The Conservative candidate for the division, Harpenden District Councillor Matt Cowley, said residents deserve a county councillor who is local to the town. He said, "The St Albans Lib Dems failed to listen to Harpenden residents over parking charges on our high street. Now they want to parachute in a councillor who represents southern St Albans to be our county councillor. We deserve better. Our community needs a local campaigner who is here every day, who experiences the consequences of the decisions of the local council, and who will fight tooth and nail to make our town an even better place to live and work. As a Harpenden South West resident with a record of standing up for our area as a councillor, I'll keep fighting to make Harpenden an even better place to live."
And now a personal view by Mary Connolly, Chair of St Albans Civic Society, on the various work that the society does in the city to make it a vibrant and welcoming place to live. And the piece is entitled "The Role of the Civic Society." Last week, while out walking, a neighbour I bumped into congratulated me on becoming Chair of the St Albans Civic Society, SACS, then promptly asked me, "So, what does the Civic Society do?" How apt, I thought. As I considered my new role and how to take it forward, I was mindful that it's part of a rich continuum, the latest in a long line of people who have contributed to the civic life of the city for over 60 years. Walking down St Peter Street, looking at the magnificent line of mature plane trees, I saw a visible sign of SACS's work. A previous hard-working committee persuaded the council in 1999 to support them in a joint fundraising effort, raised over £10,000, the trees were planted, and today we all benefit from them. Another example came to mind, a very successful joint campaign to save the Odyssey Cinema from being demolished, ensuring that a historic building survives and thrives as a vital cultural hub. Today's SACS team regularly reviews local planning applications and raises objections where they consider necessary, such as when poor design or overdevelopment jeopardise our historic cityscape. We champion the best in building design and refurbishment. To do this, we hold the biannual SACS Awards. Look around and you will see blue plaques awarded to some of the winners. For me, the idea of civic goes way beyond just buildings. Civic engagement must include a range of activities that allow individuals to contribute to the improvement of their community and society at large. At its core, it involves active participation in civic life, and for us at SACS, enhancing both the built and heritage fabric, the environment and political health of the city. We want to foster a sense of opportunities, which allows us as citizens and responsible individuals to undertake and contribute to improving the social and physical fabric of our historic city. We want to encourage active participation and engagement, to educate and inform through events such as the awards presentation and our calendar of talks. We work with and support other groups who, like us, do their best to enhance the city. In short, our aim is to continue to make St Albans a city that is vibrant, welcoming and diverse. A city which does not stand still and continues to enhance the life of both the residents and visitors alike.
Drama teacher wins national award is the headline for this article. A Harpenden drama teacher has won a national award for her exceptional dedication and leadership. Aldwickbury School's Head of Drama, Zelia Atts, was given the Drama Inspiration Award at the Music and Drama Awards 2025 in London on January 30th. This award recognises her exceptional dedication, leadership and passion for drama, which inspires pupils at the school. Miss Atts said, "I'm truly honoured to receive this award. The drama classroom is a supportive space where pupils feel free to express themselves. My goal has always been to support, empower and help each pupil to shine in their own way." The school was also shortlisted for the Outstanding School Drama Department Award. And there's a photograph of the Aldwickbury School Head of Drama, Zelia Atts, being presented with her award, and she's got a very big smile on her face.
And a personal view from Harpenden and Berkhamsted MP Victoria Collins on the launch of Children's Mental Health Week and the importance of promoting awareness and support. This week marks Children's Mental Health Week, launched by the charity called Place to Be, that has been providing counselling and support to schools in the UK since 1994. With one in five children facing mental health challenges, it has never been more important to promote awareness and support. The theme this year, Know Yourself, Grow Yourself, highlights the importance of self-awareness and personal growth. Schools across Hertfordshire are taking part in class-led activities and assemblies to help pupils foster a sense of self and grow in their abilities to connect with their peers, alongside fundraising efforts such as non-uniform days and bake sales to support Place to Be's work. As your MP and the Liberal Democrats Science, Innovation and Technology spokesperson, I have been actively advocating for better mental health provisions for children. In Parliament, I have been pressing the government on incorporating mental health considerations in key legislation, such as calling for a national wellbeing measurement and including improving the Online Safety Act, which plays an important part in safeguarding children's mental health. I have visited schools and spoken with youth groups to gain a better understanding of the challenges young people face, and have worked with organisations like Barnardo's, Internet Watch and Five Rights to see how I can make a true difference. Social media has become a key factor in children's mental well-being. While it can be a valuable tool for learning and connection, it also presents serious challenges. Exposure to harmful content, cyberbullying, and the pressures of online validation can take a toll on young minds. More and more studies show the impact of extended technology for all of us, especially during children's development. Children's Mental Health Week is a vital reminder that we all have a role to play in supporting young people and the mental challenges of young people that can go ignored. Parents, teachers and policymakers alike must work together to ensure every child has access to the resources they need so they can thrive. Only when we work together can we make a difference in the lives of young people and ensure they feel supported and understood. Regardless of your age, if you are in need of support, I encourage you to reach out. Mental health support should not be confined to one-off events. It must remain a priority in everyday life, but weeks like Children's Mental Health Week are a good place to start.
A school is to stage a musical that's entitled Legally Blonde. A school in Harpenden is set to stage a production of Legally Blonde. Catherine Warrington School will put on the popular musical in March. The show will include performances from pupils on the Level 3 Performing Arts course, which launched this academic year. James Bullock, Director of Performing Arts at Catherine Warrington, said, "Legally Blonde is a story about empowerment and breaking stereotypes. We are so proud of how our students have embraced this challenging production, and we can't wait to share their hard work and talent with our community." The performances will take place in the school's theatre from March the 27th to March the 29th, with doors opening at 6:30 p.m. and the show starting at 7 p.m. Tickets are now on sale and can be purchased online at www.create-hearts.co.uk. They cost £15 for adults and £10 for concessions, which includes students, children and seniors. The school has asked businesses to get in touch if they would like to advertise in the programme or sponsor the production. And there's a photograph with, it's obviously on stage, with a very dark background and a very dark blue surface. And then there's a group of students, all teenagers, wearing black outfits, black trousers, black t-shirts, and one girl at the front wearing white jumpsuit, really, like track pants, and a black vesty type top. And they're all leaping in the air with their arms fully stretched and all of them off the ground. A great photograph.
Fate of St. Peter Street Post Office remains uncertain. No decision has been made on the future of St. Peter Street Post Office, despite rumours of its impending closure. The facility, one of the organisation's surviving Crown Post Offices, is on the list of branches at risk of being sold to a franchisee or closing permanently. But St. Albans MP Daisy Cooper, who has been fighting to save the branch, said it would be some time before we know its fate. I've pressed the post office for details of their process, and this is what they told me. The post office is in dialogue with the unions until the end of March to consider options including retention and franchising. To gauge market appetite and explore whether franchising could be a viable option, they were inviting expressions of interest to operate post offices in all remaining DMB locations until early January. After March, they will put options on the table for consultation with the public and any affected staff. Until then, the post office assures me that they have not made any decisions about any of the Crown post offices. Meanwhile, MPs are lobbying ministers and post office bosses hard to protect the Crown post office concept, the only remaining cast-iron guarantee of any level of service across the country. And I'm lobbying hard for the protection of all services here in St Albans, for residents and small businesses.
Infuriating post office bosses have none of the answers, says MP. Blithering post office bosses have once again failed to answer simple questions over the future of the St. Peter Street branch, St. Albans MP Daisy Cooper has revealed. She condemned them for inviting expressions of interest from sub-postmasters to take over some of the services at risk of closure, without actually explaining what services they would be required to provide. This means that there are no guarantees that all of the services currently provided by the branch will continue, and no guarantees that the location would remain the same. A group of cross-party MPs grilled post office bosses about the ongoing farce for 90 minutes at a public meeting in Parliament this Tuesday, and finally forced them to admit the ludicrous situation. Daisy Cooper said afterwards, "This was yet another infuriating meeting with post office bosses where they failed to answer the questions we put to them and couldn't guarantee there won't be a reduction in service. When we MPs last met in December, they promised to come to this meeting to set out the criteria against which they would assess whether or how to keep or change the services or location of existing post office branches. Without those criteria, MPs are unable to engage in a meaningful conversation about getting the best deal for our residents. Post office bosses say that every single one of the sites at risk of closure, including the St. Peter Street branch in St. Albans, has received an application of interest. However, it's possible that these applications could come to naught if it turns out they can't meet the service requirements, but those requirements haven't even been set out. At the same time, the post office still intends to continue with setting the criteria in early March and then judging the bids against them in the same month. Having sat on their hands for the last 2 months, it's simply unacceptable that they now intend to charge ahead in a matter of weeks without discussion of what the post office service on offer could look like. We have told post office bosses that we expect them to come back to answer our questions again, but only once they've shared with us the service requirements for each of our areas and before they put their rush proposals out for public consultation.
Clothing stolen in JD Sports store robbery. Clothing has been stolen and staff were verbally threatened during a robbery at a store in London Colney. It was reported that numerous items were taken from JD Sports at Colney Fields Shopping Park at around 4:05 p.m. on Wednesday, January the 8th, after staff were verbally threatened. The incident is being linked to a similar robbery at the same location at about 5:10 p.m. on Friday, December 20th. Detective Constable Emily Foley from the St Albans Local Crime Unit said, "Our inquiries are continuing and I am urging anyone with information to please contact police. The people pictured are believed to have been in the area at the time and could have information to assist the investigation."
MP attends dementia meeting at care home. MP Victoria Collins took part in a sing-along at Willow Court Care Home in Harpenden. She met with residents and staff at the home in Old Wickbury Crescent on Friday, January 24th. The care home provides both residential and specialist dementia care. Several other dignitaries were present, including Deacon Sarah Wickett and Karen Noble from Harpenden Methodist Church. The meeting was instigated by professional musician Claire Childs, founder of Sing From The Heart, who is passionate about music in care homes and helping those living with dementia. Claire shared her personal story of her mother Christine, who started showing signs of dementia in her early 60s and sadly died in April 2024 at the age of 73. Claire and her family feel passionately that no family should struggle for help and support the way they did, and that in her memory and legacy, they want to fight for change to help other families. She also set up Harpenden Dementia Community on Facebook for those living locally needing local support, advice or guidance. Victoria Collins later met Maria Ball, CEO of Quantum Care, the provider of care at Willow Court, and Coney Anang, the home manager, to tour the premises. Maria Ball said, "We're delighted to have Victoria join us at Willow Court." And there's a photograph of three women, one of them being Victoria Collins, meeting with care home residents, sitting at a round table with a red tablecloth on and a vase of red roses and green foliage.
Tougher action needed to tackle air pollution, say District Greens. Green councillors have launched a damning attack on St Albans District Council's latest Air Quality Action Plan, or AQAP, warning it may fail to deliver meaningful improvements to local air quality. A draft plan for tackling air pollution was issued last year, covering a period up to 2029, and included measures including the promotion of low-emission transport and active travel, such as cycling and walking. Air pollution is primarily caused by the burning of fossil fuels, including emissions from cars, lorries and buses, and is recognised as a contributing factor in the onset of heart disease, respiratory illnesses and cancer. As part of these goals, the plan suggested options for tackling emissions from private vehicles, including increasing car parking charges and considering road closures, like the much-derided experimental shutting of High Street. It also called for electric-only buses through the city centre and reducing domestic combustion through the promotion of clean night, supporting households to decarbonise their energy supply, considering the implementation of a district-wide smoke control area and tackling bonfires and other unauthorised fuels. Members of the public were asked for their views on the draft AQAP, with the consultation ending on September 27th, but as yet, a final version of the plan has yet to be published. Now the Greens have issued their response, which highlights what they say are major gaps in the Council's proposals, particularly around public health integration and the monitoring of dangerous PM2.5 particles, with wood burning alone contributing 27% of these harmful emissions. Councillor Matt Fisher said, the current draft lacks clear timelines and measurable targets. Without these, we risk failing to deliver meaningful improvements to local air quality. Key recommendations include creating a real-time air quality alert system, restricting resident permits for diesel cars, implementing clean air zones, better monitoring around schools and the strategic rail freight terminal site in Park Street, expanding smoke control areas, improving cycling infrastructure. The Greens' response also emphasised the need for better transparency, recommending a dedicated air quality website and clear communication about poor air quality days. Matt added, "Air pollution affects everyone in St Albans. We need an action plan with teeth, one that sets clear deadlines and measurable outcomes for reducing pollution from all sources." The Greens are also calling for closer collaboration between public health teams and air quality officials, with clear links between air quality actions and local health priorities. And the article is accompanied by a picture of St Albans' heavily polluted Peahen Junction.
And now a list of deaths as published in this week's Hertfordshire Advertiser. Sharon Maria Bignall, née Prowell. Eric Tom Darby. Pat Buxton, 103. Emily Hilda Giddings. Joyce Lynette Noden. Les O'Leary. Winfried Klaus Adolf Wartenberg, 87. Now Gilly reading the national radio listings.
And now the radio listings for the upcoming 7 days, compiled by Angela Stone and read by Gilly Hamilton. As we stroll gently into spring, how nice it is to snuggle down with the prospect of being entertained by the variety of radio programmes available at the push of a button. We begin with those programmes serialised from Monday to Friday. Sunil Patel, An Idiot's Guide to Bagging an Heiress. The comedian embarks on a get-rich-quick scheme. It's on Radio 4 at 11:45 a.m. Burning the Books is a history of the deliberate destruction of knowledge. Radio 4 Extra, 1:30 p.m. and repeated at 7:30 p.m. The Lion, the Witch and the Wonder. Essays on the power and politics of children's fiction. Radio 4 at 1:45 p.m. Matt Chorley with News, Politics and Listeners' Views is on Radio 5 Live at 2 p.m. Composer of the Week is Jose Garcia, Radio 3 at 4 p.m. Relaxing Evenings with Zeb Zones, Classical Music to Help You Relax, 7 p.m. Classic FM. The Essay, Michael Longley's Life of Poetry, 9:45 p.m. on Radio 3. Vidya Wade, A Ghost Story, is at 10:45 p.m. on Radio 4. Now, a selection of programmes from Saturday to Friday. Saturday, Steve Wright Remembered, a tribute to the much-missed BBC disc jockey, 2 p.m. on Radio 2. Drama and Bartleby the Scrivener by Herman Melville, 3 p.m. on Radio 4. The dramatisation of the spy novel Charlie Muffin is at 5 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra. Today's opera on 3 is Verdi, La Traviata, 6 p.m. Radio 3. Buried, The Last Witness. Investigative journalists discover the legacy of the toxic chemicals, PCBs. It's at 9 p.m. on Radio 4. On to Sunday. And drama, C.S. Lewis, That Hideous Strength, Part 1 is at 3 p.m. on Radio 4. Stephen Mangan with music and features, 4 p.m. Classic FM. The music quiz Counterpoint is at 4:30 p.m. Radio 4. Tony Blackburn's Golden Hour, 7 p.m. Radio 2. St. Joan of the Anthropocene, a reimagining of Bernard Shaw's play, 8 p.m. Radio 3. And on Monday, How Boarding Schools Shaped Britain, 11 a.m. Radio 4. The drama today is Charles Paris, A Situation Tragedy, Part 3 of 4, 2:15 Radio 4. History's Youngest Heroes, Vasily Arkhipov and the End of Days, 3:30 p.m. Radio 4. Natalie Haynes stands up for the classics. Natalie takes a fresh look at the ancient world with Athene at 4:30 on Radio 4. In Somebody by Elizabeth Wainwright, a separated couple win a holiday in France, 9 p.m. Radio 4 Extra. Round off the evening with the blues shows with Keris Matthews, 9 p.m. Radio 2. On to Tuesday. Thinking Aloud. Wealth, an account of offshore finance. 3:30 p.m. Radio 4. Radio 3 in Concert features music by Ravel and Poulenc. 7:30 p.m. Radio 3. And the jazz show with Jamie Cullum is at 9 p.m. Radio 2. X-Man, the Elon Musk origin story, part 1 of 8, is at 11 p.m. Radio 4. Wednesday, the Great Post Office Trial, how the legislation to overturn the sub-postmaster's convictions was passed, 11 a.m. Radio 4. The afternoon drama is When Alan Met Ray, how the writers Galton and Simpson met and wrote comedy scripts, 2:15 p.m. Radio 4. Comedy drama, Reincarnation. Daniel Rigby and Diane Morgan star in a story about reincarnation at 6:30 p.m. Radio 4. Radio 3 in Concert features works by Corelli and Handel, 7:30 p.m. Radio 3. Finish the evening with The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe, 9 p.m. Radio 2. Next, Thursday, In Our Time, Catherine of Aragon, a discussion hosted by Melvin Bragg. It's at 9 a.m. Radio 4. Jeeves and the Feudal Spirit, more excellent P.G. Woodhouse comedy. Part 1 of 6 is at 12 noon and repeated at 6 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra. Afternoon romantic drama is Only One Word for Love, 2:15 p.m. Radio 4. In Ramblings, Claire Balding takes us on part of the Shropshire Way, 3 p.m. Radio 4. Word of Mouth, Talking Cockney with Michael Rosen, 3:30 p.m. Radio 4. POV, The New Sketch Show, 6:30 p.m. Radio 4. And rounding off the evening is The Country Show with Bob Harris, 9 p.m. Radio 2. Finally, on to Friday. On Desert Island Discs, it's Stephen Mangan's turn to be cast away, 9 a.m. Radio 4. Meet Mr. Mulliner by P.G. Woodhouse, 2:30 p.m. Radio 4 Extra. Why do we do that? Asks, why do we love dogs? 2:45 p.m. Radio 4. In Soul Music, the story of Charlie Chaplin's song Smile, 4 p.m. Radio 4 Extra. Free thinking. All we need is love. A look at love, past and present. 9 p.m. Radio 4. I hope you enjoy some of the choices.
Thanks very much, Julie. Now, another from our series, London Beyond Sight. This is one of the many items that can be found on the London Vocalise website. This time, actor David Harewood describes the Buxton Memorial Fountain.
Hello, I'm David Harewood. I'm an actor. You may have seen me on stage at the National playing such parts as Othello or Hotspur, or in Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials. Likewise on television, you may have seen me in Homeland, The Vice, or Robin Hood. I'm here today to introduce the Buxton Memorial Fountain in Victoria Tower Gardens. Although the landmark I've chosen is right in the heart of London, it seems hidden away, and lots of people don't even know it's there. Between Lambeth and Westminster Bridge, in the shadow of the Houses of Parliament, there's a beautiful chapel-like monument. It's the Buxton Memorial Fountain, built to commemorate the emancipation of the slaves in 1834. I first came across this monument 5 years ago, during the 200th anniversary of the 1807 Abolition Act. At the time, there were lots of articles about whether companies should own their links to slavery. Some did, and some didn't. The memorial kept being mentioned, so as I was cycling past, I stopped to take a look. The setting is stunning. Just 10 metres from the tree-lined bank of the Thames, in the middle of Victoria Tower Gardens. The monument is made up of an octagonal stone base, with 8 Gothic arches sitting on top, one on each side. There are pillars in between, and ornate carving above. The monument finishes with a tall, spire-like roof. The whole thing is about 5 times my height, maybe about 30 feet. You can go inside. 4 of the 8 arches are entranceways. You climb 2 steps to get to the fountain at the centre, and inside it's tall enough to stand at full height. Despite the rumble of traffic along Mill Bank, there's a sense of peace and seclusion. The monument's built from lots of different materials. Pink and grey granite, terracotta, limestone and mosaic. The enamelled metalwork on the roof is a real surprise. It's painted bright orange, pink and blue. Usually Gothic buildings are dark and imposing, but this one's dynamic and full of life. All the way around the base, you'll find limestone carved in small house-like shapes that come up to knee height. They stick out further than the roof, so the rain has smoothed and eroded them. The pillars, just above, are pink granite with red sandstone bases. Each pillar is made up of 4 slender pillars joined together. They're about 1 metre high, carved with delicate leaves at the top. Sitting just on top of them, there's an upside-down V carved in light grey stone. It frames the upper section of the arch. Just where the V's begin, there are bizarre carved creatures. Their heads stick out at us. Roaring dragons, lions with powerful claws, and lizards with mismatching crustacean bodies. Another surprising part of the monument is the mosaic. Above each arch, there's a carved circle with mosaic patterns inside. Their tiny tiles are grey, blue, green, and gold. Next to the circles, there are mosaic pictures, again of animals, a heron, a giant fish, a lizard clambering from the water while a bull drinks behind, and also a man holding a fishing net straining with fish. And above that is the beautiful roof. It's a riot of colour, a big contrast to the grey and muted pink underneath it. The spire is nearly as tall as the arches. There are 8 curved metal ridges going up it, painted bright orange. Between the ridges, there are metal sheets, painted in the pattern of roof tiles, in mint green, pastel blue, and pink. It reminds me of Islamic or Moorish art, but instead of angular shapes, It uses soft curves. Near the bottom, there are simple royal blue flowers with five round petals. Orange wrought iron leaves shoot out from the ridges, making their way up to a cross at the peak. When I go inside, I'm surprised by how secluded it feels. There's a central grey granite pillar that sparkles in the light. Around it, there are four round pink basins, at about thigh height. This was once a public drinking fountain, but it hasn't been used as a fountain for years. Water spouted from the mouths of roaring terracotta lions, which are still here, just above the basins. Above us, raised lines are carved in the stone, like the roof of a Gothic vault. These lines fan out from the tops of the pillars, and where they meet, there are bosses, circular stones carved with flowers. Back outside, you'll find carved plaques embedded under the arches, one facing Millbank, the other the Thames. The stone facing the Thames is from 1989, marking 150 years of the Anti-Slavery Society. The plaque facing Millbank is the original commemoration. It says, "Erected in 1838 by Charles Buxton MP, in commemoration of the emancipation of the slaves, 1834, and in memory of his father, Sir T. Fowell Buxton, and those associated with him, Wilberforce, Clarkson, McCulkey, Brougham, Dr. Lushingham, and others." Thomas Buxton took over as leader of the abolitionist movement when Wilberforce retired in 1825. He was also one of the founders of the Anti-Slavery Society. For me, this monument marks the crucial moment in history when the force of the evidence against the slave trade outweighed the business aspect, when Parliament and the public realized the horrors that the slave trade involved and had to acknowledge that slaves were people, not property. My name is a testament to my own family connection to slavery. My great-great-great-grandfather was born a slave on the Earl of Harewood's land in Barbados. After the Emancipation Proclamation, once enslaved people were given the names of their former owners to try to stop the trade in slaves, they were given an identity. This chapel-like memorial is a place to reflect, not just on the abolitionists, but also on the thousands of traded people who are not named here.
Now a list of audio-described programmes available on television, courtesy of our friends at the Wharfdale Talking Newspaper.
Now for the audio-described television programmes starting Saturday 8th of February and ending Friday 14th of February, compiled by Sarah and read by Diane. Starting with Saturday 8th. As is the way on Saturday mornings, there's a flurry of food-related programmes to get the day started. Rick Stein's Cornwall is on BBC One at 11:15. Simply Nigella is on BBC Two at 11:45 with steamed clams and toasty olive oil granola, followed by Raymond Blanc at 12:15. Over on ITV, it's James Martin's French Adventure at 12:40. This week he's in Anansi, where he cooks dishes using delicious local tomatoes. For a classic afternoon film, head over to BBC Two at 1:15 to watch 3 hours of Dr. Zhivago, or Channel 4 at 12:40 for Transformers Dark Side of the Moon. If you prefer a spot of the Rugby Six Nations, England are playing France with transmission starting at 4:15. This is not audio described but may still be of interest to some. There's the usual Saturday Night Light Entertainment on ITV in the evening with The Masked Singer at 7, followed by The 1% Club, hosted by Lee Mack. BBC Two continues with a couple of early evening travel series starting at 6:05 with The Balkans, Europe's Forgotten Frontier, with the BBC's Europe editor Katia Adler. This is followed at 7:10 by Liz Bonin's Wild Caribbean, when she joins residents of Mayrou in repairing their vibrant coral reef. Alan Cummings gets to travel in style on Channel 4 at 8 with Scotland's Poshest Train. Later in the evening at 9:30, ITV continues their murder mystery series North Shore, whilst over on BBC One at 9:10, you can get your weekly dose of Casualty, when Dylan is fighting to prove his innocence. You've a couple of evening films. Firstly, a comedy adventure thriller, The Lost City, on Channel 4 at 9:10. Or for something later on, there's the Oscar-winning comedy drama Jojo Rabbit at 11:20. This is also on Channel 4. Now, for Sunday's audio described options. For morning viewing, you've the choice of some regular programmes. There's Homes Under the Hammer, followed by Bargain Hunt on BBC One from 11:30. Whilst over on ITV at 11:15, you can see how the Fletchers are getting on with diversification at the farm in a new series, Fletcher's Family Farm. Early afternoon brings you some treats, starting on BBC One at 1:35 with Quentin Blake's Box of Treasures. If you prefer a quiz show, there's Pictionary on ITV at 1:40 p.m. or alternatively, a classic afternoon film, Scott of the Antarctic, on BBC Two at 1:15. There's plenty of choice in the evening, starting on Channel 4 at 5:15 with the documentary series Devon and Cornwall. This week, Fisherman Phil prepares for the annual Fish Festival. The Great Pottery Throwdown continues on Channel 4 at 7:45. This week, the potters sculpt realistic vegetable lamp bases. BBC One has Call the Midwife at 8:05, when Joyce faces a difficult decision when a mother suffers from postnatal complications. This is followed on BBC One by the second episode of the historical drama Miss Austen, while over on ITV, the series based on historical crimes continues. This is in Unforgotten, and it's on at 9 p.m. The options in the 9 o'clock slot are completed by Celebrity Hunted on Channel 4, and the final episode of Life and Death Row on BBC Two. If you fancy a late film, your choices are the classic The Elephant Man on BBC Two at 11:55, or an all-out action US Secret Service thriller London Has Fallen on Channel 4 at 11. Now for the programmes which are on at the same time, same channel, each weekday. On BBC One, there's Homes Under the Hammer at 11:15 each weekday, and The Big Ideas Work at 2. Rick Stein's Food Stories is on at 2:30 each day except Friday, and The Repair Shop is on every weekday at 4:30. BBC Two has South Pacific at 3:15 each weekday, and All Roads Lead Home Monday to Wednesday at 4:15. This is replaced on Thursday and Friday by The Earth's Greatest Spectacles. ITV have Dickinson's Deal each day at 2. The regular soap operas are on at the usual times. Monday, it's EastEnders and Emmerdale at 7:30 on BBC One and ITV respectively, followed at 8 by Corrie on ITV. Tuesday is Emmerdale at 7 and EastEnders at 7:30. Wednesday is Emmerdale at 7:30 and Corrie at 8, both on ITV. Thursday is Emmerdale at 7 and EastEnders at 7:30. And on Friday, we do get a day off from all the regular soap opera-based shenanigans. Now moving on to Monday's programmes. So, in addition to the regular programmes already mentioned, you can watch Robson Green in Weekend Escape on BBC Two at 6:30. Slightly later on Channel 4 at 8, Jamie is still serving up his £1 wonders and money-saving meals. This week he rustles up feta pasta, a carrot cake and a cheap chicken curry. There's plenty of choice in the prime time 9 o'clock slot. There's a new crime thriller, Verdi, on BBC One, whilst ITV continue with their cold case drama, Unforgotten. Over on BBC Two, Katia Adler travels to Romania, Kosovo and Serbia in the second and final part of The Balkans, Europe's Forgotten Frontier. The final option is the series Go Back to Where You Came From, which explores the reality of the refugee experience. This week, the group treks miles in the heat, dodge drone strikes in Syria, and shadow Lebanese police pickup squads. For something a little more lighthearted, continue with Channel 4 for First Dates at 10:05, followed by Celebrity Gogglebox at 11:10. Or if you prefer something more factual, you can catch Heathrow, Britain's busiest airport, on ITV at 11:40, whilst over on BBC Two at 11:05, comedian Tony Slattery turns to psychiatry for some answers to his psychological problems in What's the Matter with Tony Slattery? Now on to Tuesday. At 6:30 on BBC Two, former world and Olympic boxer Nicole Adams joins Robson Green in Weekend Escape, which is followed at 7:30 by Sweet Delights in Nadia's Fast Flavours. This week, Nadia celebrates in style with lemon drizzle swirls and a red velvet cake. If you're thinking that a bit of a tidy up wouldn't go amiss, Stacey Solomon will help put that all into perspective with Sort Your Life Out. This week, the team tackles a memory-filled home of a lively family with six triplet boys. This is followed at 9 by the continuation of the school-based drama Waterloo Road. Channel 4 helps people face their fears in The Fear Clinic, Face Your Phobia at 8 p.m. This week, we meet a gardener afraid of frogs, someone with a dread of vomiting, and Zara with a phobia against birds. This is followed at 9 by a new series, Top Guns, Inside the RAF. This week, a Reaper drone hunts ISIS terrorists and a squadron is scrambled from Cyprus to attack Houthi missile sites in Yemen. For a few laughs, head over to BBC Two at 9 when comedian David Mitchell challenges six comedians to spend a week living in the great outdoors in David Mitchell's Outsiders. Now on to Wednesday's viewing, which is as follows. Robson Green has another Weekend Escape on BBC Two at 6:30. It's not bad work if you can get it. This time he's joined by actor Rupert Penny-Jones for a getaway in Northumberland where they take a surfing lesson and go rock pooling. Over on BBC One at 8, the team tackle a range of restorations in the repair shop. This is followed at 9 on BBC One by the comedy series Amanda Land, when Amanda is forced to sell the contents of her lockup at a car boot sale. At the same time, but over on Channel 4, Kirsty and Phil meet with a family in Wolverhampton who struggle with gloomy rooms and a lack of storage. Can the team make the house perfect enough that they want to stay or not? That's in Love It or List It. The house theme continues on Channel 4 at 9 with George Clark's Building Homes series, when a family transforms a former hotel in Dunoon into a stylish family home. For even more house stuff, stay with Channel 4 at 10 for Dubai, Buying the Dream, when Connor struggles to balance work and home life, learning the hard way that Dubai's property market stops for no one. Grantchester is on ITV at 9. This week, a professor of archaeology is found murdered at a dig site outside the village. Over on BBC Two at 9, you can watch real-life drama in Murder Trial, Body in the Warehouse. The programme goes behind the scenes of a complex case shrouded in mystery. If you want to round the day off with a few giggles, join Jen and Nick for a boozy night out after a tarot card reading in the comedy Am I Being Unreasonable? Now for Thursday. In addition to the usual daytime options and soap operas, BBC One has a business-orientated evening, starting with Dragon's Den at 8. This week, a serial entrepreneur wants to change the way the nation buys crisps. That sounds like a tough challenge. This is followed at 9 by A Comedy of Errors, according to the Radio Times, also known as The Apprentice, when the teams have 9 hours to secure 9 items. It's Medical Issues over on Channel 4 rather than Business, starting with 24 Hours in A&E at 9 p.m, followed at 10 by Super Surgeons, and then finally 999 The Front Line at 11:05 p.m. For a late night film, head over to ITV at 11:15 when you can watch the musical comedy Pitch Perfect 2, or for a spooky end to your day, BBC 2 continues with the series Uncanny. This week, Danny Robbins talks to a charity shop manager who claims to have witnessed the terrifying presence of a ghostly man in her flat. Finally, on to Friday. BBC One kicks off early evening viewing at 7:30 with Extraordinary Portraits with Bill Bailey. This week, he meets East Londoner Rizwan, who has stopped 29 people from taking their own lives whilst working on the tube for 8 years. Artist Jack Dixon attempts to capture the various facets of Rizwan's personality and life through multimedia art. This is followed at 8:30 by Amanda and Alan's Spanish Job, when creative tensions rise with Amanda and Alan's opposing visions about transforming the Spanish home. Over on Channel 4 at 7:30, there's Food Unwrapped Deep South Adventure, which this week focuses on a foodie road trip through America's Deep South. As usual, the primetime slot at 9 is filled with a range of options. Sun-drenched drama in Death in Paradise on BBC One, more spooky tales in Uncanny on BBC Two, TV and Chuckles on Channel 4 with Gogglebox or Connecting a Killer, True Crime Presents on ITV, this week investigating a series of unsolved crimes in Pembrokeshire. Finally, for any night owls, there are two films on offer. Long Shot is at 11:30 on BBC One. This is a romantic comedy following a burgeoning romance between American politicians. The other one is Blue Jean on BBC Two at 11:05. This is about a PE teacher in 1980s Newcastle who hides her sexuality from her students and co-workers, but crisis looms when she spots a new pupil hanging around a gay bar. So we've got to the end of this week's Audio Described TV listings. I do hope you fancy something of interest.
Now an interesting piece from TNF Soundings. Producers of some of the world's biggest products are working to make life a little easier for people with visual impairments. Amongst other things, smart labels, cartoons and braille.
Hello, this is Tanya with an article written by Fiona. From Kellogg's to Coca-Cola, from Barbie to the Beano, the world's biggest names are all taking steps to help their visually impaired customers. Some of the world's most easily recognisable names are increasingly turning their attention to helping people with visual impairments. Some companies are employing technology to help, while others are using some good old-fashioned ideas. Grocery shopping, food, travel, toys and even comics are being made easier for visually impaired people. Kellogg's were first off the mark in 2020 in partnership with the Royal National Institute of Blind People, RNIB, when the company introduced NaviLens technology in 30 stores across the UK. This allowed a smartphone to detect and play back labelling and allergen information to shoppers from a label printed on the product. In 2021, retailer Asda introduced a quieter hour in stores with noises diminished to aid customers with certain disabilities. Recognising that large, busy supermarkets can be noisy and overwhelming for some customers, staff help by operating quieter hour in their larger stores, usually from Monday to Thursday between 2 and 3 p.m. During this time, the in-store Asda radio is turned off and staff work quietly, acknowledging this hour as a quiet time to support customers with additional needs or hidden disabilities. To find your nearest store operating the scheme, visit Asda's website, www.asda.com, and click the store locator link on the home page. In 2022, Aunt Bessie's, in a first within the frozen foods industry, partnered with the RNIB to support visually impaired shoppers, adding NaviLens technology to the packaging of two of its biggest sellers. Initially appearing on Aunt Bessie's 10 glorious golden Yorkshires and crispy and fluffy roasties, the technology helped visually impaired shoppers and made packaging more inclusive. That same year, Lego introduced Braille bricks to help visually impaired children learn Braille through play. Toolkits and training are provided free of charge to professionals working with VI children. Also in 2022, with interest hotting up, Coca-Cola became the first drinks business to launch on-pack NaviLens technology. At Christmas that year, the company rolled out codes across its can multi-packs, allowing customers to scan the code using their mobile phones. From a distance of up to 4 meters, the code allows customers to find information via the code even when unfocused. By 2023, things were really taking off. when American carrier United Airlines announced that it aims to outfit its entire mainline fleet with Braille signage by 2026. Braille will be used to denote aircraft rows and seats and will also be added inside and outside lavatories. So far, United added Braille signage on a number of its planes. The airline said it was the first US carrier to utilise Braille in cabins. The move earned praise from US National Federation of the Blind president, Mark Riccobono, who said, quote, "The flight experience is often frustrating for a number of reasons, one of which is the amount of information that is available exclusively through printed signs and other visual indicators." Unquote. In July 2024, in a first for the UK dairy industry, Müller Yogurt and Desserts rolled out Navilens codes across all its branded products, increasing accessibility for blind and partially sighted people. The move followed work done by sight loss councils across the UK, who worked together to make retail accessible. The same year, American discount chain Walmart launched an app called Aira Interpreter, which operates with the camera on the back of a smartphone and will work as shoppers' eyes inside Walmart stores. The free app is available for Apple and Android devices, and it connects customers with a trained visual interpreter to help them navigate stores. In fact, 2024 was a stellar year for blind and visually impaired shoppers and travellers. In the year, Delta Airlines introduced an accessible flight map, which will be installed in 600 planes. Ekrem Dimbiloglu, the airline's managing director of customer experience, said, quote, "The impact will be substantial since nearly half of Delta customers use the flight map feature on their seat back screen at some point during a flight, and 20% of flyers make the flight map their only engagement with the seat back screen." Unquote. Flyers can opt to use the accessible map instead of the standard flight map application with a single screen tap. For ease of use, it offers streamlined information with fewer cities and geographical features than the standard map. It also has larger fonts and icons, and it utilises a high-contrast, simple colour palette for easier visibility. In July 2024, ABC New York's Eyewitness News reported that toy company Mattel had launched the first ever blind Barbie doll in its latest move to make the iconic doll more inclusive and represent more sections of society. The company worked with both the American Foundation for the Blind and the RNIB to create this new Barbie. The doll carries a white and red cane with a marshmallow tip and wears sunglasses to provide additional eye protection. Barbie's clothes have been designed using tactile fabric, such as a satiny blouse and a textured ruffle skirt, and have brightly coloured hook fasteners to make swapping them more accessible. The packaging also features Braille writing. And finally, how could we forget the collaboration between Guide Dogs Charity and the world-famous Beano Comic, who produced the first audio comic strip created especially for people with visual impairment. In this special comic strip story, Beano characters Herbert, Minnie, Dennis and Nasha discover all about guide dogs and buddy dogs and their life-changing support when Herbert reveals to his school friends that he is living with sight loss. Entitled A Buddy for Life, the audio comic strip is available to download as a PDF file or to watch and listen on YouTube. The links are available on Guide Dogs' website at www.guidedogs.org.uk/Beano.
Once again, time to welcome Peter Burley with his take on events and entertainment upcoming in our area. Peter.
Right, we'll be doing the diary of events from mid-February to mid-March, and I'm hoping it will be nice and spring-like for us, but let's kick off with what we've got at the Cathedral. And on Saturday the 15th at 7:30 p.m, we have a concert entitled Interstellar 10, and this is linked up with the moon having been moved from its orbit and inserted in the Cathedral. And Roger Sayer is Interstellar's organist, performing Hans Zimmer's score in this concert, Underneath the Moon. And then there'll be a question and answer session with the performer afterwards if you want. Now, it doesn't say there's a charge for that, but most organ concerts are free. But beware, there may be a charge. Now, St Albans Chamber Choir on Saturday the 8th of March at 7:30 p.m. have an uplifting celebration of female composers on International Women's Day. Again, it don't give the details of pricing on that. And then we have a joint schools choral society and orchestra concert on Wednesday the 12th of March at 7:30 p.m. performed by the St Albans High School for Girls and the St Albans School Choirs. And lastly, we have on Wednesday the 19th of March an organ recital at 12:30 p.m. given by Christopher Mooley from St Albans Cathedral. Now, St Peter's Church have now published their lunchtime programme. Don't forget, they're always at 1 p.m, always on a Wednesday, don't need to book, and there's refreshments afterwards. So 19th of February, Ashley Solano on the piano. 26th of February, Alice Bishop, soprano, and David Elwin on the piano. 5th of March, Jean-Samuel Bez, violin, and Gina Kruger on the piano. And 12th of March, Anna Lahare on the piano. Now, the St Albans Symphony Orchestra have a concert on Saturday the 1st of March at 7:30 p.m, and that's going to be in St Paul's Church on Blandford Road. Now, that will be featuring Mendelssohn's Reblas Overture and also works by Dvorak and Frank. Ticket prices are £18 in the nave and £13 in the aisle. Now, Saturday the 1st of March, we have Harpeth and Choral Society inviting you to come and sing the Mozart Requiem. And that's with musical director John Andrews. That's going to be in the High Street Methodist Church. You have to pay to sing, however. This is the bad news. You'll have to pay £20 for the privilege. Now, the Organ Theatre, I've got a couple of events. The first one is an ordinary organ concert by Phil Kelsall, and that's going to be at 2:30 p.m, and tickets for that are £15. And then the next day, on Sunday the 9th of March, we have a Sunday musical afternoon featuring the collection of mechanical instruments. Doors open at 2:30 and the mechanical instruments are turned on at 3 o'clock. Admission for that is £8. Right, well, we now need to look at the Auburn Arena. And the first event is on Sunday the 16th of April at 7:30 p.m, which is Jim Davidson, The Next Chapter, it's called. And you have to be over 18 to go and listen to this one-man show. Second one is The Signatures, Northern Soul Live. So I think you can tell that it's going to be a soul music concert. But you've got to be over 12 for this one, and it'll cost you £30, Saturday the 22nd at 7:30 p.m. Then we have, on the 27th of February, the Mozart Group. They're going to be performing at 7:30 p.m, and they've sold, it says, over 5 million tickets in 50 more or more countries. And it's a hilarious twist on classical music, it says. It'll cost you £32.50. It's hysterically funny. Anybody of any age can go to it. Now, we then move on to the 80s Live on Friday the 28th of February at 7:30 p.m. And I don't think that needs much introduction from me, but it will cost you £34. On Saturday the 1st of March, two performances, 5:45 p.m. and 8:45 p.m, the Rock Orchestra. And you do have to be over 14 to listen to them. And they will cost you anything between £62.50 and £27.50. And it's in an ethereal candlelit setting, it says. We've got a good event coming up on the 6th of March at 7:30 p.m. There's an evening entitled Arsenal Legends. And it's several of the great players from Arsenal talking about their experience with the team. Presumably they're going to swear a lot because you're going to have to pay, it'd be over 14 to listen to them. Tickets for that are £40 for ordinary tickets and a VIP ticket, £72.50. Then we have the Magic of Motown on Saturday the 8th of March at 7:30 p.m. Obviously, this is a tribute concert to great Motown groups. You have to be over 14 and it will cost you £35.50. Then we have Gordon Buchanan. the one-man show entitled Lions and Tigers and Bears. And he is on at 7:30 on Wednesday, the 12th of March. You have to be over 14. Tickets are £31.50 or concessionary tickets at £29.50. And then we have on Thursday, the 13th of March, the Hertfordshire Schools County Dance Festival. And I suspect this may be of more interest to you if somebody you're related to is performing in it, but it's on twice at 2 p.m. and again 7 p.m. and it's going to be costing you between £11 and £2. And the last in our series is entitled Giovanni, The Last Dance. Now, there are two performances, both at 7:30 p.m. on Friday the 14th and Saturday the 15th. Giovanni has become a household name, electrifying performances. And tickets for that are £48 up to £132.50, and you have to be over 8. Now, let's have a go at the Harpenden Public Halls. And the first one we've got is Friday the 21st of February at 7:30 p.m, Fairport Convention. Not a tribute band. It may not be all the ones you remember from their early days, but it's the real thing. And they'll be £35. Then we have a concert entitled Celine. Now, this is a tribute concert. It's obviously a tribute to Celine Dion. It's Saturday the 22nd of February, 7:30 p.m, all tickets £30.50. Then we have another tribute concert, Oasis, misspelt with a Z at the end, obviously a tribute to the band Oasis. They're on Friday the 28th of February at 7:30 p.m, all tickets £24.50, but if you're under 18, you must be accompanied by an adult. And we have Ronnie, Reggie and Me, and this is a one-man show on Saturday the 1st of March at 7:30 p.m, and it's not about a gang of criminals. It's given by Fred Dynage, who's the policeman who helped catch them. So it's a talk about his work catching London gangland criminals. Now, on Monday the 3rd of March, 7:30 p.m, Black is the Colour of My Voice, and this is a tribute concert inspired by the life and work of Nina Simone, and it will cost you £26. Then we have Buffy Revamped on Friday the 7th of March at 7:30 p.m. And this is a one-man, I think, probably comedy-based show based on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And that's going to be £26. Paul Hopkins, Roy Orbison and the Travelling Wilburys Experience is, I think, another tribute band. But they'll be performing on Saturday the 8th of March at 7:30 p.m. All tickets £32.50. We then have How to Beat the Scammers with Nick Stapleton. And this is a one-man show on fairly obvious theme of beating scammers. He's going to be talking on Wednesday the 12th of March at 7:30 p.m, all tickets £28. And then we have Money for Nothing. And that's a tribute to Dire Straits. And that tribute band will be performing on Friday the 14th of March at 7:30 p.m, all tickets £31. Now let's have a look at what's going on drama-wise. Now, I actually have some good news to report on the drama front. Last time, I previewed a play called A Lady's Day, and at the Maltings, we have got the follow-up to that, and that's going to be Ladies Down Under, which runs from the 13th to the 22nd of February. All tickets £15, and it's at 7:30 p.m. each day. So the good news is they're the right way round. If you got to the first one, the second one will suit perfectly. Let's have a look, though, at the other things on one other event on at the Abbey Theatre, and that is Girls Like That. And it's not a sequel to the other one. It's performed by the Company of Ten. It's a play by Evan Plaisy. It's a powerful play exploring the impact of social media on teenage identity. That's running from the 13th to the 15th of February at 8 p.m. Tickets are £12 or £10 concessionary tickets. Now, there's another play on at the Maltings, and that's going to be called, well, not a play, it's an evening's entertainment. It's going to be called Rabbits Out of the Hat. That's going to be at 5:30 p.m. on the 5th of March. Tickets are £10 up to £14, and it's a whimsical play about a magic show with fun for all ages, and it's performed by vaudevillians. Now, we have a musical at the Sandpit Theatre when the Sandpit Theatre Company are going to be performing the musical Bugsy Malone. And this is the sort of comic musical based on Chicago gangsters. I'm told it's very good. It's where Jodie Foster made her breakthrough when she was a child artist. Right, that's running from the 20th to 22nd of February. Performances on both days at 2:30pm and 7:30pm. All tickets are £17.50. Now, there's a number of events on at the museum, usual Roman history talks, but there's one quite separate freestanding event on the 28th of February. There is a talk entitled Living in Comfort. And this is a talk in Verulamium Museum, and it focuses on houses and the multi-sensory experience of living in Roman residences. So I don't know whether that means you get smoke blown over you to demonstrate the hypocaust and nasty smells from the drains that didn't work properly, but it's a long, hard look at domestic living in the Roman Empire. So we'll now move on to the other talks we've got in the area, and we have got for Sahas quite a full programme, starting on Tuesday the 18th of February, optical instrument maker Samuel Jones of Dalton's, His Life and Properties, and this is given by John Mean and Kate Morris. Now, that may not mean a lot to you, but there's two things to know. Dalton's is the old name for what then became Oliver Burns and his Bleak House, so it's actually on the beginning of Catherine Street. It's a very fine building. This optical instrument maker bequeathed a huge number of drawings which have been acquired by Sahas to be lodged in their library. So there's an interesting story about an important local resident in an important local house. I should have said all these talks start at 7:45. They are free to members and £5 non-members. And that one about Samuel Jones is in the church only, so you can't book a Zoom for it. However, better news on Tuesday the 4th of March was a talk about Edmund Lutyens, Britain's greatest architect, given by Professor Clive Aslett. That will be in the church and on Zoom. Then Tuesday the 11th of March, what has gone wrong at the National Trust and what can we do about it? And that's been given by Cornelia van der Pol, who's been a campaigner in some of the disputes about some of the policies of the National Trust has been pursuing. And that's a wide range of disputes. I mean, it's everything from diversity policies through to whether they should rebuild houses that burn down, and hoping she will shed some light on it. The only thing which is kind of slightly ironic is, of course, we only have one National Trust property in the whole of Hertfordshire, which is Bernard Shaw's house. So this is all going to be about properties and policies that don't really hit hard here in St Albans. Now, the Wheatonstead History Society has a talk on the surprising history of the Swan Inn in Stevenage by John Mean. That's on the 19th of February. It's in Mead Hall in East Lane, Wheatonstead, at 7:30pm. And it's an important building in Stevenage, which was a posh coaching inn, but then had many other manifestations throughout its long life. And finally, we have the Harpenden Local History Society, 25th of February, 8pm, in the Eric Morecambe Centre. Frank O. Salisbury, painter and laureate of this parish. And that's a talk given by Stephanie Reynolds. The O is not because he's Irish, it's Frank O. full stop, Salisbury. I have to say, I think I've seen some of his work, but it's not familiar. That might be an interesting one to get along to. Anyway, that's it for our session. I will be back with you next month. We will be looking at events from March into April.
New York City, like London, has wonderful buildings and monuments. Here, Leonard Marcus describes the incomparable Brooklyn Bridge.
I'm Leonard Marcus. I live in Brooklyn, and it's my pleasure to describe for you an icon of my borough and of the city, the Brooklyn Bridge, the first bridge to connect Manhattan and Brooklyn. It was built in 1883, and before that, the only way to get between these two boroughs was by ferry. The bridge was designed by John Roebling and constructed under his supervision, and later his son and daughter-in-law, Washington and Emily Roebling. Today, many tall bridges span the East River, and of course the city is filled with skyscrapers. But in 1883, the tallest building in New York City was the spire of Trinity Church on Wall Street at 281 feet. The two towers of the Brooklyn Bridge rose to 276 feet, only 5 feet shorter. So the bridge immediately became a dominant element of the city's skyline. The Brooklyn Bridge is a suspension bridge, which means the roadway across the span is hanging from suspension cables. It was the longest suspension bridge in the world when it was built, and for about 20 years after. The section that extends above the river is 1,500 feet long, which is about a third of a mile. John Roebling was able to build such a long bridge at that time because he had invented and perfected a kind of steel wire to use. Before this, suspension bridges used wire made of iron. There are four main cables on the bridge, each appearing to be a solid cable 15 inches in diameter. But in reality, that 15 inches is made up of over 5,000 strands of steel wire that are braided and woven together for maximum strength. The bridge is 85 feet wide, with six lanes for traffic, three in each direction. Suspended above the traffic is a wooden footbridge, a promenade 15 feet wide for people to walk or bike across. If you walk to the center of the bridge, you are standing 135 feet above the surface of the East River. To understand the structure of the Brooklyn Bridge, I'm going to ask you to do a few things with your hands and arms while sitting at a table, like a dining room or kitchen table. Or, if that's not possible at this moment, imagine you are sitting at a table. Place your hands on the table directly in front of you, palms down, thumbs touching. Now, raise both hands about 6 inches, and then extend your arms to the left and right as far as you can, and drop them down to the tabletop. Where your hands end are the ends of the bridge, let's say Manhattan on the left and Brooklyn on the right. That gentle arc from where your hands began down to the tabletop on the left and right is the arc of the roadbed of the Brooklyn Bridge. Now bring your elbows in and place them on the table directly in front of you, with your fingers pointing straight up at the ceiling. Your arms now represent the main vertical parts of the bridge, the towers that support the gray suspension cables. These towers are actually standing in the East River, close to the shore on each side. The suspension cables are anchored on each shore, then gently rise to the tops of the towers. The cables then continue between the tops of the towers, which, remember, are your fingertips. But they do not go straight across from one tower to the other. Instead, they appear to hang down between the towers in a graceful curve, which gives the bridge so much of its poetic beauty. Besides these main cables, there are over 1,500 vertical cables called suspenders attached to the main cables. These drop straight down and are attached near the roadbed. When you walk or drive across the bridge, all these cables create a kind of elegant spider web of lines. You can rest your arms now while I describe the two towers, as if you are facing them directly while driving or walking across the bridge. The towers are built of large gray granite blocks quarried in Maine, and as I said before, each tower is 276 feet tall. But the towers are not solid walls of stone. Instead, each tower has twin openings within it, tall, narrow, open spaces with arched tops that come to a point. You find this same shape in the Gothic windows of many Christian churches. I love the fact that the bridge is both eminently practical in connecting Manhattan and Brooklyn, while feeling cathedral-like and monumental in its inspiring design. The Brooklyn Bridge is a National Historic Landmark and, of course, a New York City landmark. In 1883, New Yorkers marveled at what technology was capable of, and the bridge became a symbol of optimism and the future. Today, the bridge continues to inspire New Yorkers, whether poets, artists, writers, photographers, or just people on their way to work. I hope you get a chance to walk across the bridge and feel inspired yourself.
As a postscript, it's interesting to know that the term the bends, now referring to divers decompressing after a long dive, was first coined in the late 1800s by the workers at Brooklyn Bridge, who worked under pressure in what were called caissons. They had to bend over, and a lot of them lost their lives because of decompressing too quickly. At the beginning of the program, I played a brief excerpt of Watertown by Frank Sinatra. Sinatra, in my view, the most influential and significant popular singer of the 20th century, and increasingly well into the 21st century, recorded this in 1970. Watertown, subtitled A Love Story, is a studio album by Sinatra, released in March 1970 through Reprise Records. It's a concept album centered on a man from Watertown, New York. In a series of soliloquies, the nameless narrator tells his heartbreaking story of personal loss. His wife has left him and their two boys for the lure of the big city. Watertown was produced and co-written by Bob Gaudio, one of four members of the rock band The Four Seasons, with Jake Holmes also co-writing the songs. It's the only album where Sinatra ever voiced over pre-recorded orchestral tracks. That is, until he recorded the Duets albums. This album was released to mixed critical reviews and poor sales, with it being Sinatra's only major album released not to chart in the top 100 of the Billboard 200, but it has since been re-evaluated, and many consider it to be amongst his finest albums. The album is told in two parts, with an epilogue. Part 1 tells the story of the main character's disbelief in his wife leaving. Part 2 tells of the main character's desperation. A 1994 CD bonus track, Lady Day, tells the story of his wife leaving Watertown for the city. The idea of a concept album in 1970 was very new and didn't go down very well with the buying public. The same can be said of the UK when, in the early 80s, a lot of time, money and effort was spent on Dear Anyone, another concept album which disappeared without a trace. I love Watertown. Yes, it's sad and melancholy, but I consider it amongst my favourite Sinatra albums, and I have quite a few.
Nothing much happening down on Main, except a little rain. Old Watertown, everyone knows the perfect crime. Killing time. And no one's going anywhere. Living's much too easy there. It can never be a lonely place when there's the shelter of familiar faces. Who can say it's not that way? Old Watertown, so much excitement to be found. Hanging say it's not that way.
And now historical events and birthdays for the week beginning the 8th of February. Compiled by Stevenage Talking Newspapers, John and Martin. On the 9th of February 1234, the Mongol army captured the Jin city of Kaizhou. This city was the last stronghold of Jin Emperor Ai Tsung. Rather than face capture by the Mongols, Emperor Ai Tsung chose to commit suicide. The Jin dynasty, which ruled parts of northern China, had been in conflict with the Mongols for several years. The Mongol Empire, under the leadership of Genghis Khan and his successors, was expanding rapidly during this period. The fall of Kaizhou marked the end of the Jin dynasty's resistance against the Mongols. The St. Scholastica's Day riot on the 10th of February in 1355 was a significant and tragic event in the history of Oxford. The riot began on February 10, 1355, when a dispute broke out between two students of the University of Oxford and the townspeople at the Swindlestock Tavern. The altercation quickly escalated, leading to a violent clash between the university scholars and the local townspeople. The conflict lasted for several days, resulting in the deaths of 62 scholars and around 30 townspeople. The riot was named after St. Scholastica's Day, which is celebrated on February the 10th, the day the riot began. The aftermath of the riot had long-lasting effects on the relationship between the university and the town. The university was granted greater autonomy and privileges, while the townspeople were required to pay reparations and make annual penance for the deaths of the scholars. 11th of February 1809. On this date, American inventor Robert Fulton patented the steamboat. Robert Fulton was an American inventor, engineer, and artist who played a significant role in the development of steamboat technology. Fulton's early life was marked by financial struggles. Despite these challenges, Fulton received an education at a Quaker school and later became an apprentice in a Philadelphia jewelry shop where he specialized in painting miniature portraits on ivory for lockets and rings. In 1786, Fulton travelled to Europe to study painting, but he eventually shifted his focus to engineering and invention. He became interested in canal engineering and steamboat technology, leading to his development of the first commercially successful steamboat, the Clermont. In 1807, Fulton's work revolutionised transportation and had a lasting impact on trade and travel. On the 12th of February 1554, Lady Jane Grey, Queen of England for 9 days, was executed under Mary I at the Tower of London. Lady Jane Grey was a significant historical figure. She was proclaimed Queen after the death of Edward VI, but her reign lasted only 9 days before Mary I, also known as Mary Tudor, claimed the throne. Lady Jane Grey was subsequently imprisoned and later executed for treason. 13th of February 1884. This was the day on which the first volume of the Oxford English Dictionary was published. This monumental work marked a significant achievement in the field of lexicography and has since become one of the most comprehensive and authoritative dictionaries of the English language. The OED was initially conceived by the Philological Society of London in 1857, with the aim of creating a comprehensive dictionary that would cover the entire English language from its earliest records to the present day. The project was ambitious and required the collaboration of numerous scholars and volunteers who contributed to the collection and documentation of words and their meanings. The first volume, which covered the letters A to Ant, was a significant milestone in the project. The publication of the first volume was met with great acclaim and marked the beginning of a long and ongoing process of documenting the English language. The OED continues to be updated and revised to this day, reflecting the ever-evolving nature of language. 14th of February 1929. The Valentine's Day Massacre occurred in Chicago on this date, where 7 members of the Northside Gang were murdered. The massacre was a result of the ongoing gang war between the Northside Gang, led by George Bugs Moran, and the Southside Gang, led by Al Capone. The conflict was primarily over control of the lucrative bootlegging business during the Prohibition era. On the morning of February the 14th, 4 men, 2 dressed as police officers, entered a garage at 2122 North Clark Street, where members of the Northside Gang were gathered. The gang members were lined up against a wall and shot with machine guns and shotguns. the massacre was a turning point in the gang wars of Chicago, as it significantly weakened the North Side Gang and solidified Al Capone's control over the city's organized crime. Despite extensive investigations, no one was ever convicted for the murders, and the case remains officially unsolved. And finally, on the 15th of February, 1845, William Parsons, Earl of Ross, first used a 72-inch reflector telescope at Birr Castle, Parsonstown, County Offaly, in Ireland. Also known as the Leviathan of Parsonstown, this telescope was a significant advancement in astronomical technology and was the largest telescope in the world at the time. The telescope worked by using a large concave mirror to gather and focus light. It was mounted on a large, sturdy structure that allowed it to be moved and aimed at different parts of the sky. The design of the mounting system was crucial for the stability and accuracy of the telescope. And now birthdays. The 9th of February is the birthday of Carole King, the American singer-songwriter. Her first number one hit, Will You Love Me Tomorrow, was co-written with Jerry Goffin. King is considered to be one of the most successful American songwriters in the history of popular music. Her award-winning second studio album, Tapestry, was released in 1971, featuring the hits It's Too Late and I Feel the Earth Move. Joyce Grenfell, the British actress and entertainer, was born on the 10th of February, 1910. She is renowned for her songs, monologues, comic writing and film appearances, including in the St. Trinian series. Grenfell was the niece of Nancy Astor and lived for several years on the Astor family estate, Clevedon, in Buckinghamshire. In the latter years of the war, Grenfell entertained troops both at home and abroad. The 11th of February is the birthday of the veteran Labour politician Dennis Skinner. After 20 years as a mine worker, he became a member of Derbyshire County Council, subsequently becoming MP for Bolsover, a seat he retained for 49 years until losing it to the Conservative Party in 2019. No stranger to provoking political controversy, Skinner was suspended from the House of Commons on numerous occasions. Charles Darwin, the English naturalist, geologist and biologist, was born in Shrewsbury on the 12th of February, 1809. In 1831, he joined the five-year voyage of HMS Beagle, during which he observed a wide range of fossils, plants and animals, documenting his finds meticulously. He brought back many specimens for analysis, and in 1859 published his celebrated book On the Origin of Species, which detailed his theories of evolution. Jerry Springer, the American talk show host, former lawyer and politician, was born in London on the 13th of February 1944. He graduated in law from university and worked on Robert F. Kennedy's presidential campaign, serving on Cincinnati's city council, later becoming the city's mayor for 1 year. Springer was best known as the presenter of The Jerry Springer Show, the controversial television talk show notable for sometimes outrageous behavior from guests and audience. On the 14th of February, 1867, Sakishi Toyoda, the Japanese inventor and industrialist, was born. The son of a carpenter and a weaver, Toyoda built a wooden handloom in 1890. His continual pursuit of technical improvements led to the development, in 1924, of the world's first automated loom. Toyoda revolutionized the Japanese textile industry and took out numerous patents for his inventions. His work paved the way for the establishment of the Toyota Motor Company. And finally, the Italian astronomer, physicist and philosopher Galileo Galilei was born near Pisa on the 15th of February, 1564. He was condemned as a heretic by the Church, with his support of the Copernican theory that the Sun, rather than the Earth, was the centre of the solar system. Galileo was, in 1610, the first to observe Saturn with a telescope, in whose development he was highly influential. And that finishes up this edition of Primary. My thanks to Deborah, Jane, Christine, Andy and Keith for reading the news, and to Gilly for reading the radio listings. Thanks also to all at TNF Soundings, Stevenage Talking Newspapers for the Week in History and Famous Birthdays, and to Peter for Events and Entertainment. Let me take this opportunity to wish you a safe and peaceful, warm February. Please remember to return your USB stick and wallet after use, and please stay well and safe at home. Goodbye.